Vous écoutez en balado-diffusion le colloque Civic Freedom in an Age of Diversity, James Tully's Public Philosophy, présenté par le groupe de recherche sur les sociétés plurinationales. 12e épisode, conférence de Dale Turner, James Tully's Political Thought and Contemporary Indigenous Intellectual Culture.
To be once again back on their territories. Thank you so much for the invitation. I was thrilled to be asked to participate, and so far it's been wonderful. It's been great to see some. I want to say old friends, but I guess actually it is old friends. And I think what I will do is I just kind of want to walk through. How I ended up here. I had no intentions growing up of even going to university. It wasn't part of my community's culture, and I didn't, like I said, I didn't grow up seeing that as a kind of goal, or even as with what I see at Dartmouth as a kind of just a natural progression of one's life to go off to college. So, but. What did happen, though, was in 1984, the Ontario Superior Court came out with the Bear Island case, decision on the Bear Island case, which involves my community, Temagami in northern Ontario. whenever a student leaves while I'm lecturing, I always stop, and I always tell them, come back, you know, it gets better. But then I said, no, it doesn't actually. anyway, the case in the early 70s, my community initiated what was then available to them, a land caution on 10,000 square kilometers in northern Ontario. And the province of Ontario, in resisting that, and of course ultimately culminating in a Supreme Court decision, actually in 1991, I think it's got to be one of the shortest decisions, certainly on Aboriginal rights in Canada. What this case, it got me interested in how what I took to be fairly simple, straightforward explanations, or if you want to call them arguments, for why we owned our homelands, and how distorted those explanations became once they went through the machinery of the common law. And what in this ruling, Justice Steele, which we should have known, I guess, from the name if we were in trouble, but that he, in ignoring Anishinaabe ways of thinking by imposing what he referred to as the facts of historical documentation, and in his judgment, and of course we've seen this in other judgments as well, and especially Vanderpeet and Delgamuukw, that there's that Anishinaabe culture is simply inferior to Western European cultures, and that's a kind of assumption that guides the reasoning of the court. Now, this really troubled me, and naively, I thought I should go to school and learn how to think in this particular way so that I can play a role in participating in that culture, change the sort of culture from within, and that was a way that our community could sort of gain a kind of legitimacy, right, in Canadian society. So philosophy in a sense, provided, studying philosophy provided the best background for what was really my real goal, which was to study law. And in my senior year, my last year studying philosophy at Concordia, Sheila Mason taught a seminar on Wittgenstein, and for the first time, I encountered a way of thinking that made room for indigenous ways of thinking, and I wrote a paper on Aboriginal rights and Wittgenstein's concept of a language game, and Sheila recommended that I speak to James Tully at McGill, and because he was doing some interesting work and might be someone who could help. And of course, I'm certainly glad that I did, but I don't know if you remember the circumstances around this. So this is how lucky I was, in a sense. I had already been accepted at University of Toronto Law School, and it didn't feel quite right. So I was in the Paragraph bookstore, and sitting next to me was Rebecca Pates, and I heard her chatting about Taylor and Tully coming back into the department, and then I heard her mention something about Aboriginal peoples, and so I actually turned to her and interrupted her, of course, and said, excuse me, they're moving back into the philosophy department? She said, yeah. So we had this conversation. She said, you should go see him this afternoon because he has office hours, and tomorrow's the last day of the term. And so I did. I don't think I'd even been on McGill's campus at this point. So I got in line, a lineup of office hours, and here's this guy walks into the office and into his office, and I said, oh, I'm not a student in your class. Actually, I'm not a student at McGill. And I proceeded to say that, you know, who I was and where I came from and what I was interested in, and how I'd been accepted to law school. It didn't feel quite right, but I knew I kind of liked philosophy, but I knew I was never going to get a job. He listened attentively, and I don't know if you remember what you said, but he said, this is the place for you. And he said, you will make room for yourself. So I always appreciated that, because it came true. And although in some sense I still haven't forgiven, the philosophical community for taking me down a certain path that, in a way, has kind of led me off in other directions. Certainly not. So I certainly haven't ended up at this point where what I thought I was going to do initially is actually happened, or that I'm on a path for that to even happen. It just hasn't happened at all. But in my time at McGill, aside from the pro seminars that almost crushed my philosophical spirit, that's another story. I still, one of them was on Infinity, as Michael was saying, and I don't know. I think I'm still there, actually. some kind of loop or something. But what happened is that these concepts that from Wittgenstein of language games and family resemblances and showing and saying, rule following, they gradually became woven into concepts such as agonistic freedom, practices of freedom and practices of governance, and political theory, political philosophy is a critical activity. There are two, I think, two interesting articles that are really important to mention for my a sort of turn in the direction that I ultimately took. One is the Rediscovering America article, which made me see that philosophy actually could get something done with regards to indigenous rights, indigenous peoples. The other was a short article called To Follow a Rule. Short article. If you haven't read it, please do. It's a wonderful article because it lays out in a very eloquent way that perhaps there are other ways of thinking about issues and we should consider them more seriously than we have as a sort of culture and community. But I think it was your work with RCAP that really, I think, started to solidify my thinking. And I also worked at the commission for a year. I wish I could have a job like that one. It was pretty amazing job. I was the research associate to the two co-directors of research, so my job was to read the research and draft little paragraphs and summaries for the co-director, so I got a chance to read in a real sense the cutting edge of what was going on in Aboriginal issues in Canada. I think it should have saved me about 10 years in research, but it was a real eye-opening experience. And in particular, what the chapter in the first volume on the principles of the renewed relationship, originally that was referred to as the vision chapter, and it was supposed to start off the final report, the whatever 3,000 five volumes with six books. So but gradually, through the mandate of the commission and the commission's work, that vision chapter became the last chapter in the first volume, because the commission's argument was that you can't understand the principles of the new relationship unless we come to terms with our own history. Right? So Canadians need to understand how we got here. In particular, what happened to Aboriginal peoples, and come to terms with that. And as we see with this Truth and Reconciliation Commission, it's a kind of ongoing part of this larger concept, I guess, of reconciliation that's at work in Canadian society. And so, but what I got out of this, the vision chapter, and actually the commission's work, and the four principles: mutual recognition, mutual respect, mutual responsibility, and sharing. That this embodies a living relationship, an ongoing relationship that requires Indigenous voices to speak for themselves, right? And I think that is key, and to understanding, I think, what a just relationship is between Aboriginal peoples and the Canadian state and Canadian society. And of course, I took a dimension of that in looking at not so much laying out a kind of philosophical view or system, but who's going to do this kind of what role, right, should Indigenous peoples play in nurturing these kinds of dialogue between different communities? Really, 5 minutes? So, in conclusion, are there any questions? I should also mention that I did something I don't normally do. For those of you who know me, is I actually wrote a paper, and it's in my hotel room on my iPad. that my kid is playing soccer on or something. One of the concepts or that I thought about is this idea of a word warrior culture, that there are indigenous peoples, there are certain indigenous peoples whose responsibility it is to assert and protect, right, the rights and the sovereignty and the nationhood of our communities. And in order to do so, they need to engage in, for lack of a better term, Western European ways of thinking. But they do so guided by the wisdom, I guess, of their elders, or the indigenous ways of thinking that are embedded in indigenous communities. But I think now that we've seen this culture evolve, this kind of word warrior culture, in particular since 1982, right? Once Aboriginal rights created in Section 35, I think that it, although I have another, it's a longer argument, what I think Section 35 did is, in some sense, still it embedded the fundamental goals of the white paper. And, I mean, when you think about it, from 1969, the white paper, where the government says suggests, right, and attached to a view of justice, that the best way to deal with Aboriginal peoples is for us to get out of the Aboriginal business completely, level the playing field, get rid of the treaties, and welcome them, in a sense, and to facilitate that change into sort of mainstream Canadian culture. We're all the same, and that was the way, right? That was the just way that we should solve the Indian problem. Well, I think that the response to that, of course, created, out through the red paper and so on, created a politics around this language of rights. So since 1982, Aboriginal politics has been really dictated by the meaning and content of Aboriginal rights. And you can see various concepts that have evolved along the way. But of course, professionals and Aboriginal lawyers who have been doing this work. But what I see, though, is that it's not moving, I think, in the direction that I think an indigenous intellectual culture should be moving, or where there's something missing. And I think what is missing is, I'll just talk this way. what's missing, and I will actually jump to the conclusion, maybe it can bring some of these other points in the discussion. What's missing is that movement is still out of the communities, right? Indigenous peoples, indigenous knowledge, in a way, is outwards. So I think we're starting to see happen is a kind of returning, and the Idle No More movement is a good example of this, returning back to communities, making the land, right, central to indigenous ways of thinking, but more importantly, and I think this brings Jim's work back into it, and especially the work he's doing now, is a return to land itself, but it's also a return to community, and there's this evolving conversation within indigenous communities about what does it mean to be indigenous, and what does it mean to be a member of an indigenous community. And I think where the point of contact or meeting place between indigenous ways of being and thinking and Western European ways of thinking is the earth, is the environment. And I think what we're starting to see now is a movement, a global movement, of which indigenous knowledge is playing a role in participating in shaping the normative language and practices of what I take to be the most important thing for all humans, which is developing an environmental ethos. And Indigenous peoples, in that sense, not only do they participate, but they teach. So that's a kind of evolution that I see happening. And I think what is beautiful about Jim's approach is about his vision, is that his approach not only requires voices, but it requires their knowledge, it requires their ways of thinking, and most importantly, this view either leaves open or it contributes to leaving an open path for Indigenous peoples to go back to their communities. And I think that is a very difficult thing, and it's difficult, I think, to think how we keep that in balance. But I think that's where and the direction that we need to go. So word warrior culture is necessary because our survival, in a sense, depends on it. But I also see this other movement of a kind of medicine culture, right, that is starting to play a role. And this is why Aboriginal women, I think, are so important in leading this, sort of movement. So I'll stop there, I guess. Thanks.